Williams was lucky. The reversal had been a 4-3 decision. The three dissenting justices argued that the errors had been harmless ones, and that in any case they had not influenced the verdict. But none of that mattered now. Since the state Supreme Court had not found Williams innocent, they had merely thrown out the verdict, murder charges still stood against him. He would be tried a third time in Judge Oliver's court, and a third jury would deliver yet another verdict. Williams emerged from the Chatham County Jail a little thinner than before, a little grayer at the temples, and ghostly pale from having been indoors nearly 2 years. He squinted in the sun. As he and Sonny Seiler walked to a car parked at the curb, a small group of reporters and cameramen followed along, shouting questions. Did Williams think he would be acquitted at a third trial?
Yes, of course, he said.
What would be the deciding factor?
Money, he said. My case has been about money from the very beginning. The DA spends the taxpayers' money and I spend my own. $500,000 of it so far. The criminal justice system is rigged that way, in case you haven't noticed. I'd still be in jail if I hadn't been able to pay for lawyers and experts and their endless expenses. So far, I've managed to stay even with the prosecution. Dollar for dollar, tit for tat.
As he approached the car, Williams looked across Montgomery Street and saw an old black woman standing at the bus stop. She was staring in his direction through purple glasses. Williams met her glance briefly and smiled. Then he turned back to the reporters.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have said tit for tat. As I've always said, there are forces working in my favor. Forces the DA doesn't know anything about.
And what might they be?
You can put them down under the heading of miscellaneous, he said.
Within minutes, Jim Williams was back in Mercer House, back in the news, and back on people's minds again, whether they liked it or not. Chapter 26. Another Story. With a third trial in the offing, Jim Williams's case was approaching landmark status and attracting attention well beyond Savannah. Williams's air of cynical detachment lent spice to the expanding media coverage. Us magazine, The Scandal That Shook Savannah, described Williams as having a von Bulow-like demeanor. The editors of the photographic documentary A Day in the Life of America sent a photographer to Savannah with instructions to take a picture of Williams as an example of Southern decadence. The photographer, Gerd Ludwig, set up his lights and cameras in Mercer House.
He was here all day, Williams said afterward, trying his best to capture my decadence on film. I suppose I could have made it easy for him. I could have offered to pose with my most recently acquired historic relic, the dagger that Prince Yusupov used when he murdered Rasputin. That would have done nicely, don't you think? Yusupov sliced off Rasputin's cock and balls with it.
Williams took little interest in the legal side of his upcoming trial. Instead, he busied himself with the miscellaneous end of things, which is to say, he played psycho dice incessantly and allowed Minerva to become a lurking presence around Mercer House. She performed the appropriate rituals for removing a curse from the house, just in case there was one, and she also cast spells on people Williams suspected of wishing him ill. By chance, I happened to see her in the midst of one of these ceremonies. It was an afternoon in March, and the annual tour of homes was in progress. As usual, Williams had refused to open Mercer House to the tourists, but Lee and Emma Adler had happily thrown open their doors. Williams stood at his living room window, smoking a cigarillo,
and making wry comments as he watched visitors trooping up the Adler's front steps across the street. He motioned me over to the window. Two well-dressed couples were walking single file up the Adler's steps. Minerva was right behind them, carrying her trademark shopping bag. At the top of the steps, she paused while the others went inside. Then, after looking around in all directions, she reached into the bag and flung what appeared to be a handful of dirt into the little garden below. She threw another handful down the steps. Williams laughed. "Was that graveyard dirt?" I asked. "What else?" he said. "Taken from a graveyard at midnight?" "When else?" Minerva went inside the Adler's house. "What on earth is she doing in there?" I asked.
"Her usual mumbo-jumbo, I suppose," said Williams. "Twigs, leaves, feathers, exotic powders, chicken bones. I told her Lee Adler controls the DA, and that's all she had to hear. Minerva's been a very busy witch lately. She's been out at Vernonburg several times to dress down Spencer Lawton's house, and yesterday she paid a call on Judge Oliver's cottage in Tybee. She's thrown graveyard dirt at some of the best homes in Savannah, God bless her."
While Williams contented himself with these mystical manipulations, Sonny Seiler mounted a vigorous legal campaign to strengthen the position of the defense. He moved to suppress most of the evidence seized at Mercer House the night of the shooting on the grounds that the police did not have a search warrant. The motion was denied by the Georgia Supreme Court. His petition for a change of venue was likewise rejected. As the date for the trial drew near, Seiler found himself with essentially the same defense strategy as in the second trial. This time, he would not sequester the jury, which would improve matters slightly, but he had no new evidence and no new witnesses. He had decided against using Hansford's two young hustler friends and their stories about Hansford's plan to kill or injure Williams, fearing they might backfire. Besides, Hansford's penchant for violence was amply established through other witnesses. In any case, the most troublesome issue remained the total absence of gunshot residue on Danny Hansford's hand. That piece of evidence had proved decisive against Williams in both trials, despite everything the defense had done to explain it. Seiler's expert witness, Dr. Irving Stone, had testified that the downward angle of the gun, plus the blood from Hansford's hand and the delay of 12 hours before the police swabbed for residue, would have diminished the residue on Hansford's hands by 70%, but no more. It was unlikely that very much of the remaining 30% could have accidentally rubbed off on the way to the hospital, because the police had taken the routine precaution of taping paper bags over Hansford's hands before moving his body. Seiler telephoned Dr. Stone one more time to ask if there was any way he could explain a zero reading of gunshot residue. "No," Dr. Stone told him, "not with the information I have." In addition to the gunshot residue problem, Seiler was becoming concerned about Williams's testimony. It had been nearly 4 years since he had last testified, and Seiler worried that he might become confused about minor details and contradict what he had said before. 2 weeks before the trial was to begin, he insisted that Williams sit down and review his prior testimony. Any deviation in his story, even the slightest detail, would give Lawton a chance to pounce on his credibility. Seiler told Williams he would bring the transcripts to Mercer House on Saturday afternoon, and they would go over them together. Saturday morning, Williams called and invited me to sit in on the review. "Come half an hour early," Williams said. "I have something I want to tell you." The moment he opened the door, I could tell Williams knew the odds were against him. He had shaved his mustache. Seiler had tried to make him shave it for the second trial, saying it would make him look less forbidding, but Williams had refused. Now Williams was apparently willing to do anything to ingratiate himself with the jury. He came right to the point. "Sonny doesn't know this yet, but I'm going to change my story. I'm going to tell what really happened that night. It's my only chance to win this case." I made no comment. Williams drew a deep breath and then began. "The evening started out just as I've always said it did. Danny and I went to a drive-in movie. He was drinking bourbon and smoking grass. We came back to the house. He started an argument, kicked in the Atari set, grabbed me by the neck, pushed me up against the door jamb. All that's true. Then he followed me into the study, just as I've always said. We called Joe Goodman. Right after that, Danny took the tankard in his hand and said, 'This tankard has about made up its mind to go through that painting over there.' I told him to get out. He went into the hall. I heard crashing sounds. He came back with a Luger in his hand and said, 'I'm leaving tomorrow, but you're leaving tonight.' Then he raised his arm and pulled the trigger. All that's true. It's what I've been saying all along. But here's the difference. The gun was on safety. When Danny pulled the trigger, nothing happened. No bullets came out. No bullets whizzed by my arm. Danny lowered the gun, took the safety off, and ejected a live round. That gave me time to reach into the drawer and get my own gun and shoot him. I fired three times. Bam, 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 he fell dead. But he hadn't fired a shot. Then I thought, God damn, what have I done? I went around the desk, picked up his gun, fired two shots back across the desk, and dropped the gun on the floor. In the panic of the moment, I didn't know what else to do." Having said all that, Williams seemed strangely elated. "You see, it explains why there was no gunpowder on Danny's hand." He studied me carefully, looking to see my reaction to his new story. I wondered if my expression betrayed my astonishment. "The police and my lawyer, Bob Duffy, arrived at the house at the same time," he went on. "I took them into the study and told them Danny had fired at me and missed, and that I'd shot him. I had a feeling I was making a bad situation worse by sticking to that story, but I didn't see that I had any choice. Well, I've been convicted twice now, so I finally decided to tell it the way it really happened. And when I do, Spencer Lawton's case will crumble. I'll be acquitted." "I'm not sure how you figure that," I said. "Because it explains everything. The lack of gunpowder on Danny's hand, the live round on the floor, the pieces of paper on the gun, it all ties together." My guess was that Williams was using me to float a trial balloon. His new story fit the evidence well enough, and it preserved his claim of self-defense. But it was too convenient, too neat, and too late to do him much good. "If you tell that story," I said, trying not to sound too argumentative, "you'll be admitting you've committed perjury all these years."
"Yes, of course," he said. "But so what?"
Evidently, Williams did not want to be dissuaded. So I didn't tell him that I thought his new story would be music to Spencer Lawton's ears, or that if he admitted having fired all the shots, any jury, even a friendly one, would conclude that Hansford had never held a gun in his hand at all that night.
"You haven't told Sonny Seiler any of this?" I asked. "I intend to tell him as soon as he gets here."
"Good. Let Sonny Seiler deal with it. It wasn't my business to counsel Williams anyway." I shifted the conversation to innocuous topics while we waited. I told Williams that without his mustache, he had a benign look. A jury might like that. I looked out the window, watching for Seiler, and noticed Minerva sitting on a bench in the square. "Is she casting a spell on somebody?"
"Probably," said Williams. "I give her $25 a day, and I've learned not to ask questions."
Seiler arrived shortly, accompanied by his secretary and two lawyers who were assisting on the case, Don Samuel and David Botts. Seiler was out of breath.
"We got a lot to cover this afternoon," he said, "so let's get going."
We assembled in the study. Williams sat at his desk, and Seiler stood in the center of the room. He was wearing a blue blazer and a red, white, and black Georgia Bulldog tie. I felt a twinge of pity for him. His case was about to fall apart. He was full of energy, impatient to begin.
"Now, Jim," he said, "we're coming into this trial with some serious problems, and I don't want to give Lawton a chance to tangle you up on cross-examination. If you get up there and say you blinked twice before you shot Hansford, he'll say, 'But, Mr. Williams, didn't you testify on an earlier occasion that you blinked three times?'"
"Sonny," said Williams, "before we get into all of that, there's something I want to tell you about my testimony."
"Okay," said Seiler, "but just wait a minute. I want to review where we stand. Number one, we have not been able to get a change of venue. Number two, our motion to suppress the evidence has been denied. Number three, we've had a hell of a time trying to deal with that damn gunshot residue test."
"I know all about that, Sonny," said Williams. "What I have to say has a direct bearing on it."
"Just hear me out, then you can go ahead."
Exasperated, Williams sat back in his chair, arms crossed. Seiler continued. "A couple of weeks ago, Dr. Stone told me he could not explain how Danny could have fired a gun and still had zero gunpowder on his hand. He made a suggestion, though. He said, 'Why don't you go back out to Candler Hospital and see if you can find out what they did with Hansford's body before they swabbed his hands for gunpowder. Maybe you'll come up with something.' He said the more a body is moved or touched, the more likely it is that gunpowder will be wiped off. I went out to the hospital yesterday and asked for the file on Hansford. They gave me the autopsy report. Nothing new about that. We've had a copy of it all along. But this copy had a top sheet I hadn't seen before. It was a green hospital admitting form filled out by the nurse in charge of the emergency room, Marilyn Case. She had written a note on it: 'Hands bagged bilaterally in emergency department.' This piqued my curiosity, so I called her up and asked her to explain it. She said it meant she had put bags over both of Danny's hands so the gunpowder wouldn't rub off. The coroner had called and told her to do it."
"I said, 'Wait a minute. The police said they put bags on Hansford's hands back at Mercer House. You mean to tell me that there were no bags on Hansford's hands when he arrived at the emergency room?' 'I'm sure of it,' she said. 'I bagged the hands myself.'"
Seiler was glowing.
"Do you know what this means?" he said. "It means the police didn't bag the hands at all. They've been lying all along. They forgot to bag the hands. They wrapped Hansford in a blanket, lifted him onto a gurney, wheeled him into an ambulance, drove him out to the hospital, wheeled him into the emergency room, lifted him off the gurney, unwrapped him, and all that time his bare hands were flopping around and rubbing against his shirt, his jeans, the blanket, and rubbing off all that gunshot residue. I called Dr. Stone and I told him what I'd found. 'Sonny,' he said, 'you struck gold.'"
Seiler pulled a copy of the admissions sheet out of his briefcase.
"Here it is, Coach," he said. "The death knell of Spencer Lawton's precious gunshot residue test. They based their whole case on it, damn it, and we're gonna kick it right between the goalposts. What's worse, Lawton was obligated to give us a copy of this sheet along with the autopsy report, and he didn't. So we've caught him hiding the evidence again. He's gonna have fits when we hit him with it."
Seiler put the paper back in his briefcase and snapped it shut.
"Okay, Jim," he said. "Your turn."
William sat with his chin cupped in his hand. He glanced at me, flickered his eyebrows, and then looked back at Siler.
"Never mind, Sonny," he said. "It's not important."
I left Mercer House that afternoon with the uncomfortable feeling that I knew more than I wanted to know. Around midnight, I stopped in at Sweet Georgia Brown's and sat down on the piano bench next to Joe.
"I need to ask you about a point of law," I said.
"I knew you'd get into trouble writing that book of yours," Joe said. "But like I told you, that's what I'm here for."
"This is a purely hypothetical question," I said. "Suppose an unnamed person, an upstanding citizen minding his own business, happened to become privy to inside information about a criminal case. Something secret, something that contradicts sworn testimony. Would this person be an accessory after the fact if he just kept quiet about it?"
Joe looked at me and smiled broadly while continuing to play the piano. "You wouldn't be trying to tell me Jim Williams has finally told you one of his many alternate versions of how he shot Danny Hansford, would you?"
"Who said anything about Jim Williams?"
"Oh, that's right," said Joe. "We were speaking hypothetically, weren't we? Well, according to the law, this unnamed person is under no obligation to divulge his secret information, which, if it's what I think it is not all that secret anyway. In fact, I was beginning to wonder how long it was going to take a certain writer from New York to find out something half of Savannah already knows."
As Joe spoke, a policeman and a policewoman approached and stood awkwardly by the side of the piano.
"Mr. Joe Odom," the policeman said.
"That's me," said Joe.
"We have orders to place you under arrest."
"You do? What's the charge?"
Joe went on playing the piano.
"Scofflaw," said the policewoman. "We're from Thunderbolt. You got 6 unpaid speeding tickets and a U-turn violation."
"Any bad check charges?" Joe asked.
"No, just the speeding tickets and the U-turn," the woman said.
"Well, that's a relief." "We'll have to take you to Thunderbolt in the squad car," the policeman said. "Once we book you and relieve you of $200 for bond, why, you can be on your way."
"Fair enough," said Joe. "But I'd be much obliged if you'd bear with me while I finish up a couple of things. I was just giving my friend here some legal advice, and—"
He leaned closer to the two officers and lowered his voice.
"See that old couple sitting by the ice machine? They've driven in from Swainsboro to celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary, and they've asked me to play a medley of their favorite songs. I'm about halfway through. I'll be done with both of these chores in about 4 or 5 minutes, if it's okay with you."
The policewoman murmured it would be fine, and the two of them took seats near the door. Joe sent the waiter over with Cokes and turned back to me.
"Now about this not-so-secret secret information," he said.
"I would tell this unnamed person, in case he's interested, that in all of Jim Williams's versions of how he shot Danny Hansford, there are certain consistent points. The shooting happened in the course of an argument and on the spur of the moment. It was not a premeditated killing. The victim was an out-of-control, drunk, drug-addicted kid with a history of violence, and the defendant was a frightened, angry, non-violent older man with no criminal record. That's a scenario for manslaughter, maybe, but not first-degree murder. And in Georgia, a conviction for manslaughter usually carries a sentence of 5 to 10 years with 2 years to serve. Jim's already served 2 years."
"I suppose you could look at it that way," I said, "if you wanted to.
Anyhow, that's my answer to your question about the point of law."
Thanks, I said. And now, there is the small matter of my consultation fee. I'm thinking I'll waive it in exchange for a small favor. All you have to do is follow a certain squad car out to Thunderbolt in a few minutes, then turn around and drive a certain Attorney Scofflaw back to town.
It's a deal, I said. Joe finished his medley with a flourish. He went over to the bar, and while Mandy's head was turned, took $200 out of the cash register. On his way out the door, he stopped to pay his respects to the couple from Swainsboro. The woman wore a large pink corsage pinned above her heart.
"Oh, Joe," she said, "that was lovely. Thank you so much."
Her husband stood and shook Joe's hand.
"It ain't but midnight, Joe. Why are you leaving so early?"
Joe smoothed the lapels of his tuxedo and straightened his plaid bow tie.
"I've just been informed there's an official motorcade leaving for Thunderbolt, and I've been invited to ride in the lead car."
"My word," said the woman. "That's a great honor."
"Yes, ma'am," said Joe. "You could look at it that way, if you wanted to."
Chapter 27 Lucky Number. Blanche Williams came into the dining room and took her seat at the dinner table for lunch.
"The cat won't eat," she said.
Jim Williams looked up from the Sotheby's auction catalog he had brought with him to the table. He looked at the cat, who was sitting motionless in the doorway. Then he returned his attention to the catalog. Mrs. Williams unfolded her napkin and put it in her lap.
"It's the same as last time," she said. "The cat wouldn't eat then either. Or the time before that. It's happened every time we've come back from the courthouse to wait for the jury to make up its mind. She's refused to eat."
Williams's sister, Dorothy Kingery, glanced at her watch.
"It's 1:30," she said. "They've been at it 3 hours now. I guess they're having lunch. I wonder if they'll take a break or go right on deliberating while they eat."
Williams looked up from his auction catalog. "Listen to this," he said. "When Catherine of Braganza, the Infanta of Portugal, arrived in England in 1662 to marry Charles II, she brought with her the largest dowry ever. Part of the dowry was the port of Bombay in India." He laughed. "Now that's the kind of princess I like."
"This makes the third time she's done it," Mrs. Williams said. "Not touched her food."
Dorothy Kingery regarded the sandwich on her plate.
"Sonny says he'll call from the courthouse as soon as there's word. I hope we can hear the telephone from in here." "I don't know how she knows," Mrs. Williams mused softly. "But she always knows."
Jim Williams suddenly closed the auction catalog and stood up.
"I've got an idea," he said. "We'll eat lunch on the dishes from the Nanking cargo, just for good luck."
He took several blue and white plates out of the break front cabinet and passed them around the table. His mother and sister transferred their sandwiches from their plain white plates to the blue and white plates. The blue and white plates had been part of a huge shipment of Chinese export porcelain that had been lost in the South China Sea in 1752 and salvaged in 1983. Williams had bought several dozen plates, cups, and bowls at a highly publicized Christie's auction, and they had arrived at Mercer House within the past few weeks. "These plates have been sitting on the bottom of the ocean for 230 years, he said. "But they're still brand new. When they were found, they were in their original packing crates. They're in mint condition. No one has ever eaten off them before. We're the first." "Funny way to preserve dishes, isn't it?" Mrs. Williams lifted her sandwich and looked at her plate.
You can't fool a cat, she said.
Two weeks earlier, on the first day of Williams's third trial, the outcome had seemed a foregone conclusion. So much so that the Savannah Morning News had announced in a weary headline, Williams faces yet another conviction for murder. The jury of 9 women and 3 men seemed predisposed to hand down a third conviction. All of them, having been subjected to 6 years of relentless publicity, admitted that they knew about the case and were aware that 2 prior juries had already found Williams guilty. The tension and suspense of the first 2 trials had given way to a feeling of grim inevitability. Television cameras were stationed outside the courthouse once again, but this time the spectator benches in the courtroom were only half full. Prentice Crowe declared he wouldn't even bother to read the news reports. It was all becoming such a bore.
It's the same old story over and over, he said, like reruns of I Love Lucy.
The courthouse flack was among those who did attend. He sat slumped in his seat with one arm hooked over the back as if to keep himself from sliding off onto the floor. As usual, he was an oracle of courthouse wisdom and rumor.
Jim Williams's guilt or innocence is no longer the issue, he said. Spencer Lawton's incompetence is the issue. The question on everybody's mind is, how long will he keep screwing up? I mean, this case is getting to be like a bad bullfight. Lawton's the matador who can't finish off the bull. Twice now he's plunged the sword in, but the bull's still on his feet, and the fans are getting restless. Lawton looks ridiculous.
The prosecution led off with its by now familiar repertory company of witnesses, the police photographer, the officers who came to Mercer House the night of the shooting, the lab technicians. Each responded to Spencer Lawton's questions, then submitted to cross-examination by Sonny Seiler, and left the stand. Judge Oliver nodded sleepily on the bench. The courthouse flack yawned.
"What part did you play in the removal of the body from Mercer House?" Lawton asked Detective Joseph Jordan, as he had in each of the first 2 trials.
"I bagged the hands," Jordan answered.
"Could you explain to the jury what you mean by bagging the hands and what the purpose for that would be?"
"Any time there's a shooting," said Detective Jordan, "and you have reason to believe that a dead person has fired a weapon, paper bags are placed over the hands to prevent any foreign substance from getting on the hands and contaminating them, or any gunpowder residue, if there is any, from being accidentally wiped off."
A poker-faced Sonny Seiler cross-examined the unsuspecting Detective Jordan.
"What kind of bags did you use?"
"Paper bags."
"What did you bind them with?"
"I believe it was evidence tape."
"Are you absolutely sure those hands were bagged before they left the house?"
"I bagged them," said Jordan.
When the prosecution rested its case, Sonny Seiler rose to summon his first witness.
"Call Marilyn Case," he said.
A fresh face, a new witness, a change in the script. The courthouse flack leaned forward in his seat. Judge Oliver opened both eyes. Lawton and his assistant exchanged wary glances. She was curly-headed and blonde, about 40, and she wore a gray suit with a white silk blouse. She said she had worked as a nurse at Candler Hospital for 15 years. Before that, she had served as assistant coroner of Chatham County. Yes, she had been on duty in the Candler emergency room when Danny Hansford's body was brought in. Seiler handed her a copy of the hospital admission sheet, then strode nonchalantly past Spencer Lawton and dropped another copy on the table in front of him. While Lawton and his assistant huddled over the piece of paper, Seiler placed a blow-up of it on an easel in front of the jury,
and went on with his questioning.
Let me ask you, Ms. Case, if you recognize this document.
Yes, sir, I do.
Is that your handwriting on it?
Yes, sir, it is.
Tell this jury, Ms. Case, ma'am, whether or not Danny Hansford's hands were bagged when you received him at the hospital.
No, sir, they were not.
A murmur of surprise swept the courtroom. Judge Oliver gaveled the room to silence.
All right, Ms. Case, Siler went on. So you bagged the hands yourself?
Yes, I did.
How did you do it?
I got 2 plastic garbage bags, put them over both hands, and wrapped adhesive tape around the wrists.
After a brief and faltering cross-examination by a shaken Spencer Lawton, Marilyn Case stepped down from the stand. Siler next called Dr. Stone, the forensic pathologist. Dr. Stone said that because Hansford's hands had not been bagged before he was moved to the hospital, all traces of gunshot residue could easily have been wiped off. He then added gently that by using plastic garbage bags instead of paper bags, the well-meaning Marilyn Case had actually made matters worse.
Plastic bags are an absolute no-no, he said. They create static electricity, which can actually pull particles from the hand. Furthermore, if the body is then placed in a refrigerated morgue bin for 5 hours, as Hansford's body was, condensation forms inside the plastic bag, and water just kinda runs off the hands.
In light of all that, Siler asked, are you surprised that there was no gunshot residue on Hansford's hands?
I'd be surprised if there had been any, said Dr. Stone. Television stations cut into their afternoon programming with the news flash.
Shocking new evidence has come to light in the Jim Williams murder trial. The district attorney has been taken by complete surprise. Word around the courthouse is that Williams will walk.
Later that night, Sonny Siler arrived at the 1790 restaurant for dinner and received a standing ovation. Lawton, having lost the use of his leading piece of evidence, shifted gears for his final argument.
We don't need the gunshot residue test to prove that Jim Williams is guilty, he said. It's only one piece of evidence among many.
Point by point, he enumerated the surviving evidence against Jim Williams. The placement of bullet fragments, the bits of paper on the gun, the trajectory of fire, the chair leg on Hansford's pants, the blood on Hansford's hand, but no blood on his gun. In particular, he focused on the 36-minute gap between the time Hansford was shot and Williams's call to the police.
What did Jim Williams do in that 36 minutes? Lawton asked. I'll tell you what he did. He got another gun, went over to where Danny was lying, and shot a bullet into the desk. Then he pulled Danny's hand out from under his body and put it over the gun. What did he do for the balance of the time? I'll tell you what he did. He went around the house selectively destroying furniture.
Lawton held up the police photographs of the interior of Mercer House.
This is the grandfather clock Danny Hansford allegedly knocked over. It's face down in the hall. Notice how the base of the clock is still very close to the wall. I submit that's not where it would be if a strong 21-year-old like Danny Hansford had thrown it over in a violent rage. It would have hit that tile floor and skidded down the hall. But it's barely moved out from the wall. That's because Jim Williams did it. He leaned the clock over carefully and let it drop from a few inches off the floor, high enough to crack the case and break the glass, but not high enough to damage it beyond repair. If you recall, Jim Williams told you he was able to restore it and sell it.
Now let's see what other damage was done. A chair and a table were turned over. A silver tray was knocked off a table. An Atari set was stomped. And a half pint of bourbon was smashed.
the total damage being, what, $120.17? I don't know. But I ask you to look at all the expensive antiques that weren't broken. Chests, tables, paintings, worth $50,000, $100,000. Ask yourself whether a young man on a murderous rampage tearing up furniture in the home of somebody who loved antiques would have stopped at the trifling damage he did. Of course not. That furniture was broken, if you will, by a man who loved it, by Jim Williams.
The solemn faces in the jury box gave every indication that Lawton had recouped at least some of the ground he had lost earlier. Lawton's voice was heavy with sarcasm.
What Jim Williams didn't do in those 36 minutes was call for an ambulance. He's been described as a compassionate man who makes contributions to the Humane Society. Well, he didn't even call the Humane Society to come check on Danny Hansford.
A young female juror wiped her eyes with a handkerchief.
"We can spot them, the gunshot residue test," Lawton said. "We don't need it to convict Jim Williams."
By the end of the day, the palpable shift in the jury's mood had alarmed Sonny Seiler. Lawton had effectively rebuilt his case around the surviving pieces of physical evidence, diverting attention from the embarrassment of the bagged hands. There was nothing Seiler could do about it now. He had already rested his case and delivered his closing argument. The judge sent the jury home for the night. The next morning he read his instructions, and the jury retired to consider its verdict. Back at Mercer House, the Williamses finished their sandwiches in silence. Mrs. Williams folded her napkin and gazed out the window. Dorothy fidgeted with a spoon. Williams flipped through the Sotheby's catalog, not really reading. The telephone rang. It was Sonny Seiler, reporting that the jury was having hamburgers for lunch. At 4:30, Seiler called again to say that the jury had asked to have a dictionary sent in. One of the jurors did not know the meaning of the word malice. At 5:30, Judge Oliver sent the jury home for the weekend, still deadlocked. Seiler had learned from the bailiffs, who were notorious for prying and telling tales, that the jurors were evenly split. Deliberations resumed at 10 o'clock Monday morning. Around noon, Seiler noticed that the bailiffs had suddenly stopped talking to him. They averted their eyes when he passed in the corridor. It was an ominous sign.
"That means a decision is coming down in favor of the prosecution," he said.
By 3 o'clock, the split had widened to 11-1 in favor of conviction. The forewoman of the jury sent a note to the judge. "There is one person who refuses to change her mind no matter what we say or do." Within minutes, the bailiffs let it be known that the lone holdout was a woman named Cecilia Tayo, a feisty divorcee in her late 50s. Mrs. Tayo had told the other jurors that years ago she had found herself in a life-and-death situation not unlike the one Jim Williams described. Her live-in boyfriend had come into the kitchen in a drunken rage and tried to strangle her while she was cooking dinner. Just as she was about to black out, she grabbed a fillet knife and stabbed him in the ribs, wounding but not killing him. Mrs. Tayo said she understood the meaning of self-defense better than anyone else on the jury, and she would not change her vote. "My three children are all grown up," she said. "I don't have to go home and cook. I don't have any responsibilities. I can stay here as long as any of you can." At 5 o'clock, the judge summoned all parties into the courtroom. Williams came from Mercer House, Seiler from his office. The jury took its place in the jury box. Mrs. Tayo, her white hair wound in a bun, sat with her jaw set, staring sullenly at the floor. She neither looked at nor spoke to the other jurors.
"Madam Foreman, have you arrived at a verdict?"
"I'm sorry, Your Honor," the forewoman said. "We have not."
"Do you believe that if you deliberate further, you will get a verdict?"
"I'm beginning to believe, Your Honor, that we could deliberate until hell freezes over and not get a verdict."
Sonny Seiler moved for a mistrial, but Judge Oliver brusquely denied it. Instead, over Seiler's objections, he read a dynamite charge to the jury, which essentially told them in blunt terms to stop dawdling and come to a unanimous decision. He then adjourned the proceedings until 10 o'clock the next morning, admonishing the jurors, as he had done many times before, not to read, listen to, or watch news reports of the trial, and not to discuss the case with anyone. Jim Williams drove home from the courthouse, but instead of going inside, he walked across the street into Monterey Square and sat down on a bench next to Minerva.
"My lawyers have fucked up again," he said. "There's only one juror who's still on my side. It's a woman."
"How strong is she?"
Minerva asked.
"I don't know. She's pretty ornery, I think. But she'll be under a lot of pressure tonight. The DA knows who she is, and he's desperate to break her. We've got to stop him."
"Do you know where she live at?"
"I can find out. Can you protect her?"
Minerva gazed into space.
"There's things I can do."
"Well, this time I want you to use your most potent weapons."
Minerva nodded.
"When I get through laying down my shit, she'll be safe all right."
"Do me a favor," said Williams. "When you do whatever you're gonna do, use something that belonged to Dr. Buzzard. Like one of his old socks, or a shirt, or a comb. Anything."
Minerva gave Williams a look of irritation.
"I didn't keep none of his socks. And if I did, I wouldn't know where in hell to start looking for him in that mess I got in my house."
"Well, but you have other things of his."
"I don't know. I didn't keep nothing. I didn't really know the man that good."
"Now, Minerva, we've known each other too long for that."
Williams spoke as if he were addressing a recalcitrant child. "Those are his purple spectacles you're wearing, aren't they?" Minerva heaved a sigh.
"Let's see. I think I ran across a pair of his shoes the other day. Oh, Lord, I don't know what I done with them shoes."
"It doesn't have to be a shoe. What else have you got?"
Minerva gazed up into the tree.
"Well, somewhere, if I have the strength to look, I might find something. Yeah, something."
She smiled.
"I think I even got his false teeth somewhere."
"Well, now's the time to use them," said Williams, a note of urgency entering his voice. "I don't want anybody messing around with that woman tonight."
"They may try messing,"
said Minerva.
"But if they do, they're gonna fall sick real quick. May even die."
"That won't do me any good," Williams said. "I don't want anybody getting to her at all, period. What can you do about that?"
"I will go to the flower garden later tonight," she said. "At dead time. I've talked to the old man."
"Good."
A smile spread itself across the moonscape of Minerva's round face.
"And then, when I get through dealing with your business, I'll make him give me a number."
"Oh, don't do that, Minerva. You know he won't give you one. You'll just make him angry. No, no, tonight's not a good night for that."
Minerva's smile withered to a pout.
but I need a number to play so I can get me some money, she said.
All right, goddammit, I'll give you the number myself right now.
Minerva looked sharply at Williams. You've always said I was wise, he said.
Yes, I know. You was born with the veil over your face, baby. You do have the gift.
Tell me how many numbers you need.
I need a triple number, like 1, 2, 3. It can be the same number 3 times or 3 different numbers.
All right, said Williams. Let me concentrate for a second. Then I'll give you a number that will win you a handful of money.
Williams closed his eyes.
The numbers are 6, 8, and 1.
6, 8, 1,
Minerva repeated.
That's right. Now how much money does it take to play it? $1, $5, $10?
A flicker of doubt crossed Minerva's face.
You might be teasing me.
I don't tease, said Williams. But you haven't answered my question. What does it take to cover the bet?
$6.
How much would you win if you won?
$300. But hey, this thing played 2 tracks,
she said.
Which track to play, New York or Brooklyn? Me, I play New York track. I don't want to play 6-8-1 on New York and have it come Brooklyn. Which one to play?
Can't you play both?
Hell no. That would take another $6. And listen, the man that writes the numbers for the other track, for Brooklyn, he lives 70 miles from me. So I got to have a number for the New York track.
Williams closed his eyes again.
Okay, I see it now. It's the New York track. Play 6-8-1 on the New York track. You'll win $300 for sure. I'll give you the $6 to cover the bet.
Minerva took the money.
But remember one thing, said Williams. 6-8-1 will work only if you leave Dr. Buzzard alone tonight and don't hound him for a number. If you bug him, 6-8-1 will automatically become worthless.
I leave him be, baby.
Good, said Williams. I want the two of you to concentrate on only one thing tonight, keeping Mrs. Tayo on my side. I don't want you or the old man wasting energy on numbers again until this thing is over.
Minerva nodded solemnly.
And don't you worry about the $300. It's as good as in your pocket. Do you follow me?
Minerva stuffed the $6 into her bag.
Yeah, baby. I follow you.
The third floor of the Chatham County Courthouse was a scene of turmoil and confusion at 10 o'clock the next morning. The doors of Judge Oliver's courtroom remained chained and padlocked. The crowd of spectators milling around in the corridor was augmented by the presence of Sheriff Mitchell and a half dozen of his deputies. The sheriff and his men had come to the courthouse in anticipation of a guilty verdict. Afterward, they would escort Williams through the underground passage to jail. But the padlock on the courtroom door was unusual. It meant that the session would be delayed in starting. Something unexpected had happened. This is what it was. At 7 that morning, Spencer Lawton had received a telephone call from a paramedic who worked for LifeStar, an emergency medical service. The paramedic said that at 2:30, an anonymous woman had called the service and asked medical questions pertaining to a shooting between an older man and a younger man. How long would it take blood to congeal on a person's hand? How quickly would a person die if he had been shot in the aorta? Though she refused to identify herself, the woman eventually admitted she was a juror in the Jim Williams case, and that she was the only one who believed Williams was innocent. She added that the other jurors had commented that the case was about a couple of faggots, and that they should just convict Williams and go home. Lawton immediately called Judge Oliver and demanded that Mrs. Tayo be expelled from the jury for discussing the case outside the jury room and be replaced by one of the alternate jurors. This would all but guarantee a guilty verdict. Siler, when he heard about it, insisted the judge declare a mistrial. At 10 o'clock, while the crowd buzzed in the corridor outside the locked courtroom, Judge Oliver convened a Star Chamber session in his office in an effort to deal with the situation. In the presence of Lawton, Siler, a court stenographer, and the paramedic, the judge summoned each of the jurors individually and asked them, under oath, if they had called a paramedic in the middle of the night to discuss the case. Each said no, including Mrs. Tayo, although when Mrs. Tayo left the room, the paramedic told the judge, "That voice is familiar to me." Out in the corridor, speculation centered on three possibilities. That Mrs. Tayo had made the call, that the paramedic had been duped by someone acting in league with the prosecution, and that the paramedic was in active collusion with the prosecution. Having failed to get a confession out of anybody, Judge Oliver reopened the courtroom and called the court back into session. Once again, he asked the jurors if any of them had discussed the case with a paramedic. None spoke up. Mrs. Tayo, looking distressed, held a handkerchief to her mouth. She had confided to the forewoman that she had recently suffered a heart attack and was afraid she might be on the verge of having another. Siler moved for a mistrial. The judge rebuffed him and sent the jury, including Mrs. Tayo, back into deliberations. In the expectation that something might happen soon, Williams went out into the corridor to wait. Minerva was sitting alone at the far end. He walked over and stood in front of her. She spoke to him as if in a trance.
"Last night I done took the old man's teeth and buried them in that lady's yard, just like you said."
"They've been up to mischief anyhow," said Williams. "They've concocted a story, and they're trying to throw her off the jury."
"That would be their only hope," said Minerva, "'cause she ain't switching sides. That's for sure, and I ain't lying. The old man done took the case hisself this time, And after midnight, me and Delia worked the DA and the judge up one side and down the other."
Williams smiled.
"Did you play that number I gave you?"
"Didn't have no time to play it. I've been too busy."
About noon, the judge called the jury back into the courtroom and asked if there had been any movement toward a decision. There had not. Reluctantly, he declared a mistrial and gaveled the proceedings to a close. Amid the ensuing commotion, Spencer Lawton's voice could be heard calling out to the judge,
"For the record, Your Honor, I will ask the court administrator to set this case down for a retrial as soon as possible."
A fourth trial would set a record. Jim Williams would become the first person ever to be tried 4 times for murder in the state of Georgia. The courthouse flack laughed and slapped his thighs and hooted that the matador was now bloodier than the bull. Downstairs, the television crews converged on Lawton, who, though bloody, was still unbowed.
"After 3 trials, he said, "the score is 35-1 for conviction. I'm confident that if we get a jury that is willing and able to decide, we'll get the right verdict."
As he spoke, a small crowd gathered around him. Minerva stood on the periphery, a broad smile on her face, and 3 crisp $100 bills crumpled in her hand. Later that evening, Williams sipped Madeira and played round after round of psycho dice. His gray tiger cat, having just eaten her first bite of food in 2 days, lay sleeping in his lap. Williams calculated that his 3rd trial had cost him roughly $250,000.
"As far as I'm concerned,"
he said. Only $300 of it was worth a damn.